Well, it's certainly a rousing adventure story that you've written in Cyclops. I don't think you've left anything out. You've got a shootout with the Cubans. You've got a fight to the death. You've got a U.S.-Soviet clash on the moon. You've got underwater diving, of course, the antique blimp. Is there anything you left out?
Well, it's a joke that I threw in everything but the kitchen sink, and I came close with the bathtub.
That's right. You have the bathtub in there, too. It reminds me of Tolstoy. He had finished writing War and Peace, an effort that took him 10 years, and after the book had gone to press, he woke up in the middle of the night, and he was screaming. He said, my God, I left out the yacht race. And so... You did not have a yacht race in Cyclops, but then you really didn't need one. You are quoted in People, I think it was People Magazine. You are quoted here in the article that I saw that you're not a great writer of literature. You are an entertainer. What's the difference between literature and entertainment?
To me, I think that the what they call literature is really in the prose. The who are called the literary writers, we'll say, Bellow, obviously, for example. The interesting thing is they do write, you know, this marvelous prose, but the most of them don't plot too well, which I've always been fascinated by. Hemingway could plot, of course. Fitzgerald couldn't. That's why Hemingway could translate better to motion pictures and Fitzgerald never could, I believe. So I think really when you take your literary critics or reviewers or whatever, when they lean what they say the higher tone literature, I think they're talking that the prose is probably on a jazzier plane, where I suppose I would be classed as a commercial writer. But I always looked upon myself as an entertainer. A lot of writers will say I'm a storyteller, but... I think that my job is to entertain the reader, and that's what I try to do. There's no message. I don't have any great opinion to give out or anything like that. I'm trying to entertain the reader in such a way that when he puts down the book, he feels like that his money was well spent.
Now, I remember taking a favorite relative of mine many years ago to see George M. on Broadway. Mm-hmm. George M. had starred Joel Grey.
Right.
And we had fair seats toward the front, and... it was a wonderful show, great music, and as we walked out, my relative said, he said, it was wonderful. He said, I sat there for 2 hours and loved every minute of it, and I didn't have to think.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly, really. There's nothing wrong with that. I think writing is like art. An artist can, there's a specialty. He may, you know, do abstract, he may do portrait, whatever. Landscapes, seascapes, and the writer is the same situation. We all write in a kind of a different type of style and different genres. So it's really varied, but so many of the, like the New York Times, really doesn't pick up too much on the commercial end. I know a friend of mine, Timothy Foote, who used to be an editor for the Time magazine, came on an expedition with me, and I was kidding him. I said, you've never reviewed me in Time magazine. He said, no. He said, quite frankly, that, you know, we try to keep it in what he classed as the literary type books. But you just have this wide variance of style, and everybody writes a different story and a different genre, and you develop, you know, certain following, and some are more universal than others. Danielle Steele would have a very wide audience, we'll say, the female and some male. Robert Ludlum, of course, has a great audience for his work. Harold Robbins did it one time. So these would be classed as commercial writers, such as myself, too. But there again, I still look upon myself as, you know, trying to turn something out that's entertaining to the reader.
Well, you've done that, and I also think it's well-written because you write in a very spare prose style that's easy to follow. And if the truth be known, the fact of the matter is that highly literary books are not popular and do not reach great numbers of people.
They don't sell, right?
A case in point is a fellow Simon & Schuster writer named Robert Coover. I just did a profile of Robert Coover, whose latest book is called Gerald's Party. Now, it's a book I admired because... it was a major effort of imagination, but there's no plot to it. Mm-hmm. And as a matter of fact, there are no chapters.
It's
a long book, mm-hmm. and people are going to start reading it, and they're going to be confounded by it, and possibly, if they don't know Robert Cooper, may well put it down, because Robert Cooper appeals to Robert Cooper fans, a certain amount.
There's a niche there for it. So,
but he is not going to, in spite of the 9 years of effort that he put into that book, I would imagine that he would not come close to having the kind of literary sales that you will have with Cyclops.
The interesting aspect that sometimes I bring up at a writer's conference, which usually is called blasphemy, but still there can be a great comparison compared to writing a book as to simply producing a product, which in essence you are. You can take somebody invents this product and comes to the manufacturer with it. They look it over and decide this should sell. So what do? They research and, you know, develop and refine and modify, and then it goes into production. And then it's taken to the distributor, and it's then to the wholesaler and put out on the retail level. And if it's a better mousetrap, it sells. And I think a book, nobody uses it on this level because the writing is supposed to be high tone, but I think basically it comes down to that you are producing a product, and if you have a more universally accepted product, and there again the better mousetrap bit than somebody else, it'll sell more.
There's an interesting coincidence involving your novel Cyclops, and that's where the space shuttle Gettysburg, isn't it? Space shuttle Gettysburg?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is returning to Earth, and the Russians are seeking to divert it to Cuba, and of course Dirk Pitt, well, I shouldn't say whether he saves the day or not, save that for the reader to find out, but with the space disaster this week and knowing what can happen to a space shuttle, that was an interesting part of the book. At the news conference that NASA held yesterday, one of the reporters raised the possibility of sabotage, and that reporter was cut off, and they didn't want to talk about that. It may be ridiculous to think of sabotage, I don't know, but isn't it interesting that this coincidence developed, that this happened, this horrible tragedy happened, and here it was, in a way, almost foreseen the possibility of something like that in Cyclops.
This was, let's say, an unfortunate coincidence that the book had come out when this happened, because generally, like Ray's The Titanic, it eventually was found. And so there was a tie in there. But I've written Pitt into the future by a few years. And the reason I did this was after studying the series Heroes when I started in, I noticed that if Fleming's James Bond, after 5 years, was terribly dated. So I started moving Pitt up on about the third, fourth book. I think maybe it was Titanic. I moved him into the future by 10 years or so. Of course, we're catching up, and I have to keep him going ahead. And throwing in a little things, holographic telephones, because 10 years, times don't change that much. You and I will still get up in the morning and go to work, but the biggest change we've seen in the last 20 years is we watch color television now and then, of course, the computers. But we don't live that differently, and so it's fun to try and predict. It'd be nice to sit here and say, now, what country will have a big upheaval that I can, you know, lay a plot into that would work out? Well, you can't, unless you're psychic, and I'm not, you can't do it. And, you know, if somebody would have guessed Iran, I think Erdman kind of came a little close with a crash of 79 or whatever. But so that's what happens. I'll try to do that sort of thing. I did have another instance where I pulled the battleship Iowa out of mothballs in Vixen 03, and I got quite a thrill when I was out surveying the York River for a shipwreck when the Iowa actually sailed by out to sea, because I never thought they'd pull her out. So it's kind of fun to try and dream up this sort of thing. Night Probe Canada became a part of the United States, which will probably happen, maybe not in our lifetime, but who knows, 100, 200 years down the line.
Don't hold your breath.
Yeah, that's true. But you never know. We're so close, it's ridiculous. And who knows, maybe Castro will soften someday, and, you know, and we can start getting Havana cigars again.
Now, tell me, Dirk Pitt, what was his first book? What was the first one that he was in?
Mediterranean Caper was the first one published, but Pacific Vortex was the first one I wrote. It was a case like, I think, Ludlam with The Road to Godolphin. I was sitting with an editor after we'd finished editing Night Probe, and I mentioned that the first one I ever wrote I threw on a closet shelf because I didn't feel it was good enough. Well, of course, now, because I had a following, he got all excited, so I pulled it down and I spent time rewriting it as much as I could. And then they put it out as Pacific Vortex.
Well, Dirk Pitt has not been in all the books.
Yes.
Oh, he is in all the books. Every one of them.
Right.
So he was your hero from the very inception.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting aspect, because everybody brings up the fact that people will buy a Clive Cussler book, where with Fleming they bought a James Bond book. But Pitt, for some reason, I think this is why I've developed him in a different vein. With most series heroes, you start in chapter one and you walk through the whole story with them. Pitt comes in and out. Dixon 03, he was out the first 80 pages. He was in, and then he went out for 100 pages. So it's a case that there's so many plots going on that even Pitt isn't aware of a lot of the subplots from beginning to end. So it's a case he's a pivotal character, but he's not the only central character. And as a result, even people that have read all eight books still have a hard time conceiving that this is a series hero situation.
Wow, in all of the books. Mm-hmm. Now, Vixen, you say Vixen 03 was the first one published.
No, Mediterranean Caper was the first one published.
But not the first one written.
Right, that was the second. And Pacific Vortex, as I know it's complicated, was the first one written and about the, I don't know, fifth or sixth published. So if somebody wanted to read them in their natural order, they'd start with Pacific Vortex, then go to Mediterranean Caper and on through.
Okay, what year was Mediterranean Caper published?
1973 for the first time.
So you have roughly been turning out a book every year or 2 years?
Oh, a year and a half, roughly.
What happened? What was life for you before 1973?
I was in advertising for about 18 years.
West Coast?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then when I moved to Denver, it was kind of probably interesting that I was just getting tired of, let's say, the lifestyle. My wife and I had grown up in California. She was a native. And I decided I wanted to write. I'd written two books part-time, which were not published, which would have been Vortex and Caper, and then I'd signed with an agent. So I was driving home one night, and it was hotter than hell, and the traffic was backed up on the Long Beach Freeway, and I pulled over and just said, I'm not going back. So I told my wife, and she said, fine, you'll probably live 10 years longer. So we planned for it for about 6 months and eventually sold the house, stored the furniture, sold the boat. We lived in Newport Beach. Thank God I sold the boat. Bought a new car and a tent trailer. The kids were in grammar school, so it was no traumatic shock to leave. So off we went and spent the most marvelous 3 months as a family we ever spent traveling in the western United States. And I had this kind of a dream situation where let's go to Aspen. Well, we never skied. We got to Aspen, but in 1970 the town was all hippies and dogs, so we pushed on into Denver. And I thought, well, the town's okay, but we weren't that crazy about it. And somebody said, be sure and go back out west. We were going back to the west coast of Oregon, Coos Bay. And he said, be sure and go over the Rocky Mountain National Park. Well, there's a beautiful little town at the entrance called Estes Park. So we just fell in love with it, stayed there. I wrote Iceberg in Estes Park and still wasn't published. So I went back to work for an advertising agency in Denver and worked for them for about, 2 years and built them up. Because it was kind of a small agency, very unsophisticated. So I built them up to, they expanded the staff, had an image of this creative agency. And they brought in a new man from New York. We didn't like each other, and I wasn't a corporate infighter, so I was sacked. So then I went home in an unfinished basement and sat there and wrote Raise the Titanic. So it's always been a joke in Denver. I should take out an ad in the Rocky Mountain News and thank the agency for sacking me.
You yourself are a diver, isn't that true?
Yes, I've been diving for years.
How does it feel being a diver and living, of course, here I see you in a pool, but that doesn't count. How does it feel being a diver and living in a landlocked area of the country?
I get kidded a lot, like, you know, raising the Titanic and never leaving the Rocky Mountains. I don't know. It doesn't hurt because of the research. There's no problem. Plus, I'll fly around. And I'm at sea 60 days out of the year anyway on the shipwreck. And I'll probably move someday and go back to the ocean. I lived by the ocean for 25 years. And I still love it, actually, more than the mountains. My wife enjoys the mountains. But I'll probably move back one of these days. I'll never own another boat, though. That was a pain. But I miss the water, and I'll probably go back.
Tell me about the National Underwater and Marine Agency, which, of course, is the outfit that Dirk Pitt is involved in your novels. But apparently, there is actually something like that that you have formed.
Yes, in the when I wrote the first book, Vortex, in the end, I had Admiral Sandecker ask Pitt, you know, if he would come with him, because he was forming this new governmental agency, the National Underwater and Marine Agency. So from that point on, Pitt has been Special Projects Director for NUMA. Well, when we, my first shipwreck expedition to look for John Paul Jones' famous frigate, the Bonhomme Richard, my accountant said you should form a nonprofit foundation because other people would be involved, plus the tax situation and so forth. So we did, and the trustees outvoted me, and they said it would be great fun that we call ours NUMA just like Pitt's, so they did. And so it's a case, yes, Virginia, there really is a NUMA. Only one's a fictitional governmental agency, and the real one is a nonprofit foundation.
Now, the these searches, underwater searches, you have had, I think it said here, 60? 50? You had some 50? No,
I think we found about 52 wrecks.
Now, here it is. Mm-hmm. It says more than 50 lost ships. Why do you do this?
Good question. I know my wife and accountant think I belong in the loony bin because there's no return. I don't keep artifacts. I don't search for treasure. The idea is to preserve our maritime heritage by locating and surveying the lost ships of historical significance before they're gone entirely, in the hopes that someday, 20, 50, 100, 200, whatever the case, years it may take, that we're followed by the necessary groups, government, state, federal, with the funding and the technology to raise the artifacts, preserve them, or in some cases even raise these ships. So that's pretty much what we're all about, and I know it's a do-gooder type of project, but I just get a great thrill of accomplishment in researching a wreck and then going out and finding one.
Is this what you do on your summer vacations?
Pretty much. I'm usually out 2-3 times a year. So in some cases we're lucky. In other cases, like the Richard, I've been looking for that for years and haven't found it yet. And other wrecks we've just gone out and almost stubbed their toe on.
But you have a pretty good idea where they are based on records of the day, is that correct?
Well, that's difficult. You'd be amazed. Let's say you and I are standing out in the street and you know, a meteor falls out of the sky. And it's surprising, big play in the New York Times and the radio and the TV, that somebody who tries to research it, let's say 50 or 100 years later, nobody mentioned the exact corner that it went down on. You know, maybe it just says, you know, fell in Manhattan. And that's what you're faced with on so much of this. You're very, very rarely led directly to a shipwreck because nobody put down exactly where it went to the bottom. Once in a while, you get a clue. Now, we found Vanderbilt's famous steamer, the Lexington, here in Long Island Sound a couple of years ago. And it burned and sank in 1840, killed 150 people. And there's always interesting stories about a wreck. An artist drew this flaming Lexington, you know, people on fire and jumping overboard, and became quite famous. His name was Currier, and he hooked up with a fellow by the name of Ives, and Currier's lithograph of the burning of the Lexington made him, and for a while it hung in practically every house in America for a short time. And James Wadsworth Longfellow was had reserved passage on the boat, and he missed it. He got down to the dock as it was pulling off, and the reason he missed it, he was having an argument with his editor over changes in a poem he wrote called The Wreck of the Hesperus. So there's always a lot of strange tales that go on, but we were told that we'd never find it, that the ship probably was salvaged a long time ago, and people had looked, and it wasn't there. And the last report was it was drifting past Egret Head or something out there. Well, we kept researching and researching, and finally an archivist in Washington found the coroner's report. And in the coroner's report, this fellow stated that he talked to the lighthouse keeper at Old Field Point, which is near Port Jefferson. And the lighthouse keeper stated that the wreck went down about 3 a.m. When the flames disappeared, and he said it was about 4 miles north and slightly west of the lighthouse. He wasn't off much. It was 3.5 miles north and slightly west. We found the Lexington, and one of the reasons nobody had found it, divers hadn't, was too deep. It was 140 feet. And the lobstermen hadn't caught on it because it was lying right under where the Port Jefferson Bridgeport, Connecticut ferry has been running since the 1870s. So we never say die, but it's, we were lucky in a sense. We did have a lead. Oftentimes we don't. Other times we can, I'll find a map on one occasion that listed where these sunken ships were, and we went out and found them.
Sounds to me as though you enjoy the research as much as you do the actual diving.
Well, the research is fun. I really enjoy that. I could live in a library. Interesting story in the book field was Governor Lamb of Colorado threw a luncheon for myself and Leon Uris and Louis L'Amour because it turned out that the three of us, being from Colorado, were all on the bestseller list at the same time, which was kind of unusual. And he went around the table and was asking various questions. Of course, he's into fiction too, and I think he was pumping us, but he asked Louis how much he'd spent on research for the walking drum. And Louis said about $200,000. And then he asked Uris how much he'd spend in Hajj, and Uris said, well, I've gone back and forth to, Israel and the Middle East, a number of times, and I've got at least probably $250,000. And they came to me, and they said, how much do you have in Deep Six? And I said, well, maybe five, maybe 10,000, but that would be it, because I don't travel to the area. I just pick up the telephone. People are just marvelous over the phone when you research. For example, if I was describing a cabinet meeting in the White House, I'll pick up the phone, I'll call the White House curator, and I'll say, describe the cabinet room. And she'd tell me it's a kidney-shaped mahogany table. The president sits with his back to the Rose Garden. The carpet is blue. There's a painting of Harry Truman over the, east mantle or something. So I just put that in a simple paragraph to establish the scene, and it's correct. So that's part's fun.
Something else I should ask you about, too. Your hero, Dirk Pitt, drives a fancy car. What is that? Wasn't it Duesenberg, was it? What was
it? No, it was Talbot Lago. And Cyclops? No, he drove a Daimler.
Yeah. And I also understand that this is kind of a reflection of your own fascination, another hobby of yours, which deals with your automobiles. Tell me a little bit about this antique automobile collection of yours.
Well, mine and Pitt started about the same time.
How many does Pitt have? Same.
I don't know if I've ever totaled out Pitt's cars or not. I don't think I've come up with a total. He has different items. What happened was... in the Mediterranean Caper, the second book, the villain drove a car called the Maybach Zeppelin, which was quite a marvelous classic car. It was built in Germany, a big V12 engine, and they're worth probably about $200,000-$300,000 today. And in the end of the book, after the villain was taken care of, Pitt glommed onto the car, so he was driving the Maybach in the end of the book. So then I gave Pitt this old hangar at Washington International Airport where he has his car collection. And what I've done, every time I'll mention a car or something like Raise the Titanic, he pulled up one of the old cars which is known to be on the ship, Renault. And, of course, now that Renault's in Pitt's collection. Night Prover, there was this train that was missing. He has the Pullman car sitting in his garage. In Iceberg, there was a Ford tri-motor airplane, which Pitt now has in his hangar. So it's kind of fun, and then I got the idea, why don't we drive the same cars? So that's what's been happening. Deep Six, Pitt had this Talbot Lago, which I have one. The Daimler. I say it's Pitt's Daimler, but actually, of course, it's mine.
Do you go to automobile auctions, or do you track them down through, through wanted ads, or for-sale ads in the paper, or what?
Occasionally, there are automobile collector-type magazines, books that have ads. Hemmings is one. I just got back from Scottsdale, where they had the big auction, and the Barrett-Jackson auction down there, where they had close to 800 cars, and I think they did about $10 million in sales. So it's fun. It's like the horse set. You meet the same people. You have parties, and you sit there. I think one time we were bidding on a car. I forget the fellow who plays Grizzly Adams. He was bidding. George Hamilton was bidding, and I was bidding, and I think we all Hamilton finally got the car. So it's really a lot of fun, and I get a great deal of enjoyment out of restoring them.
You must have a large spread with all those. How many? You have more than 35 cars?
35. Mm-hmm.
I live in Manhattan in an apartment. I don't have room for my books. And here you have 35 cars. You must have an acreage up there in the mountains. It's in the mountains, right?
Actually, it's a little below where I keep them. I used to have them when I started collecting. I had them scattered all over town. It would be just like I'd come to you and, can I rent your garage? And so my friends and neighbors all had my cars. And then I got together with my partner now, who restores cars. So we bought some property and built a warehouse, and he restores them up in the front, and then I store mine in the back.
So you do a lot of the work yourself, then, or most of it, huh?
No, actually, not as much. I don't have the time. I love to do it, but I just don't have the time anymore, because it's a consuming process. So he'll do probably 99% of it, really, and it's good therapy for me when I'm writing and I've just about had it. I'll just knock off at 2 o'clock and go down and get greasy at the warehouse.
Well, you said you don't have very much time. I can understand that, collecting cars and going on sea hunts and researching books and writing them. Do you have any spare time at all in which you do nothing?
Usually I kind of bag out in the evening. I'll sit there and spin my satellite dish around trying to pick up crazy programs. But
this week, I understand HBO has started scrambling their signals now.
Yes, they've scrambled. But it's probably a question of a few years, and you can buy a computerized unit that will unscramble all of them, if you punch in the right key. But we'll have to wait and see. But, no, I'm remiss as far as my readership goes that I'm not a dedicated writer to where I snap off one book and I jump into the next one. I do when I'm writing. I'll write 7 days a week, and I suppose the old advertising ties, I still write from 9 to 5. It is interesting how many writers write at different hours.
With Cyclops and the other books, Cyclops is a very complicated book because there are so many things going on and so many different characters. How do you organize yourself to write so that you remember everybody who's in the book and you tie up all the loose ends?
I wish I knew. I'm always amazed when I meet somebody who turns out 20 different outlines and several manuscripts. I'll just have a scrap of paper where I keep straight that Don Swaim, for example, has light brown hair and so high and whatever, just so that I don't change the name somewhere down the line or put you with the wrong color eyes. But the rest of it's all in my head. I don't know how I keep all these plots juggled, but somehow I do, and I'm not what you'd call an intelligent man at all. But I just, for some reason, just have a knack for juggling all the characters and the plots and then miraculously threading the needle at the end.
Do you work closely with an editor?
No, I've always, it's always been my thing, I suppose, being a product of the Depression, that, you know, everything, I don't like to owe money, and so every manuscript I've ever written was finished before it even was sold. I've just made a contract recently, but this is the first time where I ever took a dollar in advance of the manuscript. Before, I always stood and fell on the finished product.
Well, Clive Cussler, there's not much question in my mind after reading Cyclops that readers are going to enjoy it. In fact, they're going to have a hard time putting it down. It's a wonderful adventure story. It's got all the elements that people who like that genre are going to love. So I congratulate you on that, and you're certainly an interesting guy.
Thank you.
I appreciate very much that you took the time out, come in and talk to me.
My pleasure.